Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is FlexiBits founder, that's a good one, Michael Simmons. Michael, good afternoon. It's nice to have you on the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I've been hearing very good things about FlexiBits. Our Jeff Gammon is a big fan of Fantastical. He told me about it a while back, and that's how I got to know you through Jeff and his ravings about how great Fantastical is. It's a very good product, I've told you, and you've won an award for it?
More than one, a few. I like to be proud of those awards because we worked really hard to get them. But yeah, just really, really proud of the awards we've won.
Excellent, excellent. Well, as is our custom on this show, we spend a little bit of time talking to the guest about how they got where they are. The other day, you were telling me that you've been in this business for about 20 years. Take us back. How did it all get started?
So, interestingly enough, it started as a kid in the late 70s, early 80s, becoming a video gamer and getting into computers like the Commodore 64. I just was always into computers, and being into computers at that time meant being into video games. And I remember as a kid admiring design and admiring how a game worked, or admiring when there was a special thing about a game, be it a sound or a graphic. I always just remember being impressed by little details. And then eventually the Amiga came out from Commodore as well, and that was just amazing in terms of graphics and sound, and that kind of upped the ante of my awareness of special things, be it graphics and sounds.
That was a famous computer, the Amiga.
Yeah, very famous. And the games, and again, the graphics and sound were just amazing, just industry changing. And it always stuck with me that I always remember, or whenever I'd see a video game or a computer or whatever, I'd always look for things that were different and better and surprising and delighting. And then I went off to school, and I went to college for film. And as part of going to college for communication, which, I mean, the major was actually communication, but it was a focus on film, I was very interested in storytelling and the assembly of a story, the assembly of a timeline and of a script, if you will. And after I graduated college, I ended up going to work, believe it or not, in the video game industry. Kind of makes sense, right? I was into games a lot being younger, and video games do, in essence, are like a movie. There's a script.
Was that in the coding area, or was that in the sort of like the storyboarding side of the game?
It was actually, believe it or not, in the quality assurance kind of production part of it. Finding problems with continuity, finding problems with the game itself, finding problems with the storyline, you know, bugs, if you will. So it was more of a critical tear apart of the game, if you will.
What company was this?
Claim Entertainment, which of course was a very famous company. And Claim Entertainment was known for doing NBA Jam and Mortal Kombat. And
were these console games or Apple II?
These were console games. And of course they were a ton of Batman ports and things like that. They did a lot of licensing, but they did have those big titles like NBA Jam and Mortal Kombat. Now, you're probably wondering where Apple fits into all of this.
I
hear you getting at that. So I wasn't actually an Apple guy until I was in college in the like mid 90s. And I will tell you, I'll back up one other thing. So I did have a job in high school working for a very famous Apple store. I'm from New York originally, and there was a very famous Apple store on Long Island called the Bite Shop. And the Bite Shop actually got started here in the Bay Area. I live in the Bay Area now. The Bite Shop is sort of one of Apple's first stores that ever sold apples. It was sort of, if you read about Apple history and Apple lore, you'll hear about the Bite Shop.
And for the listeners, back in the days before Apple had its own retail stores, there were these various independent stores. Some of them were singles and some were chains, like you said.
That's right.
That sold qualified Apple retailers and repair centers.
That's right. And being in New York, obviously far away from Silicon Valley, there weren't a lot of computer stores. There were computer stores, obviously, but the Bite Shop was the biggest, without a doubt, the biggest Apple dealer. And I actually worked for the Bite Shop for a few years. So I was into Apples in the sense that, you know, I worked at that store and I admired them. But at that point, I was an Amiga guy and a Commodore guy. So it was one of those things where, you know, when you find something you like, you kind of stick with it. I always admired Apples. I always thought they were cool. I definitely saw that they had the quality and the packaging and they seemed like a very premium product. But I was an Amiga guy at that time. And then in college, one of my suite mates was a Mac guy, and he sort of turned me on to the Mac. And at that point, the Amiga was gone. So I remember seeing the details, like the icons and how you could customize things. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I could see getting a Macintosh.
Isn't there a lingering Amiga cult that continues today, if I recall?
Yeah. Amiga's definitely hardcore fans. Anyone who was an Amiga fan is still an Amiga fan, and we love to talk about it. I could definitely do a whole show just talking about Amiga.
Are there Amiga simulators for the Macintosh?
Yeah, there are. And there's also, there's the best thing to do, I think, is just go on YouTube and Google a lot of, search for a lot of Amiga things, because you can really see the quality that this thing had back in the 80s and 90s.
Okay, so I interrupted you. Let's get back to the Byte Shop.
That's all right. So Byte Shop was really my sort of first seeing of Apple, but I got into Apple in college in the 90s, between, like, let's say 92 and 96. And then, So I ended up getting a Mac at that point in college, and I loved Mac, and that's when I became a Mac user. I ended up not working. I ended up the next job after Acclaim, because we were talking about Acclaim, was actually not anything in the computer industry. It was in the technology industry, but it's not necessarily relevant. It had to do with television and video. But right around 2000, I ended up doing some beta testing for a company out here in California. And that beta testing just consisted of, I believe it was free, like it was volunteer beta testing. Like, you know, when a company calls for beta testers and they say, test our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe I just started testing stuff. And one of the lead engineers was very impressed with the bugs I was finding and with the feedback I was providing in terms of user interface stuff. And he was saying, you should come work for us. And I remember at the time, like, yeah, whatever. You know, I thought he was just being nice. And next thing I knew, I was on a plane flying out to California, having them hire me.
That's a good thing for listeners to pay attention to, is that kind of process that you just described often leads to your first job.
Yeah. And the ironic part of it was, I was just doing free beta testing, doing what I loved to do, which was try out new products before other people get to, right? It's kind of a nice feeling to be in. And also make a difference if you're actually able to find a bug, if you're able to give a suggestion where something doesn't feel right and make the product better, you're a little part of that product's performance and success, hopefully.
Well, you're shoulders to shoulder with the programmers. So you're hanging around with them. You see how they live. You see how they work.
Yeah, exactly. And so then I ended up moving out to California, and I ended up working for that company. That company ended up, so it was a subsidiary. The company was ProSoft Engineering, but they had a subsidiary called Radiologic.
Oh, yeah, ProSoft. We know them well.
Yeah, and Radiologic had a CD application called CD Master. It was CD burning software. And that's what I ended up working on. And that product ended up getting acquired by Apple about a year later and got rolled into iTunes and the OS as the CD burning software.
Was that iDVD you're referring to?
No, it was just iTunes. And I mean, iDVD had burning as well, and that eventually came later. But the specific thing they acquired it for was doing iTunes music burning and OS burning as well.
Okay.
So then after the company was sold to Apple, I ended up staying at ProSoft a bit longer. I don't know if you know their current product, Data Rescue.
I use it. I also use Data Backup 3.
All right. Well, Data Rescue was actually my product. I actually am the one that started that product at ProSoft. Yep. It was a very exciting time. So then I ended up leaving ProSoft about a year after Data Rescue happened and went over to Apple and worked at Apple a few years.
So what year was this?
This would be around 2001,
That's when I joined. I joined Apple in August of 2000.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Good to know. Maybe our paths crossed there somehow.
Maybe we did. We just forgot.
I'm surprised I remember my timeline so well going. And, you know, it's funny.
It's a big event in your life. You remember every little detail.
It's true. But it's amazing now when I think about it being, you know, almost 20 years. It doesn't seem like 20 years. Yeah. So then there was Apple. And then after Apple, I ended up leaving Apple because me and my wife, we ended up moving up north by Sacramento. And when we moved up there, I ended up getting a job locally with they do software for Mac. It's a physics company. It's not relevant to, well, I guess it's relevant in the sense that, you know, everything to my career led to where I am now. But
Physics. You mentioned the magic word to me.
Oh, you like physics?
I was a physicist for most of my career.
All right. Then you probably know the company I worked for. You know Pasco Scientific?
Yes.
Yeah, so I worked for Pasco Scientific for a while. They were a great company. They are a great company. I did some stuff there for a few years. And then while I was at Pasco, someone I knew had approached me and said, we're looking for a good product marketing, design, development idea guy. I think you'd be perfect. And the company was Ambrosia Software, which everyone knows and loves.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew and loved Ambrosia Software very well. In fact, going back to my college, this is a great segue back to me getting into the Mac. When I went to college in upstate New York, I remember before I even had a Mac, we had Macs in our labs. And one of the games that I remember always being so impressed by was Maelstrom. And this was, of course, an Ambrosia game. So it was kind of, I always had a soft spot in my heart for Ambrosia. I always loved the company. I love what it stood for. They were very cool in that they made games and other things. They made their own stuff and they self-published. They self-published and they published others. It was just a really cool company. I just always admired Ambrosia. So I was really excited in finding out more about this opportunity. So I ended up talking with the founder and we hit it off really good. And I ended up going to work there for about 2 years. And that was a really, really great gig. And I'd say great turning point of what set the stage for where I am now. Because even though I worked for ProSoft and Radiologic and did Mac software then, and that was sort of the true start, Ambrosia was where there was a lot of creative. In other words, ProSoft and Radiologic wasn't a very creative job. Yeah, there was data rescue, and yeah, there was CD burning software, but that was very, very nuts and bolts utility type apps. Ambrosia, I worked on a product called Wiretap Studio, which I'm sure you know is a great audio editing app, capture app. Yep. And I also worked on Snaps Pro, and I worked on some games. There's a game actually that was published at Ambrosia called Aquaria. That was my project, and I actually had started that on the Mac. It was originally on Windows, and I thought the game was so great. I said, hey, we should bring this to Mac, and we did. So Ambrosia was a really good experience to start to think outside the box and sort of spread my wings of creativity and doing things nicely and differently.
That's an amazing resume, Michael.
Thanks.
It is cool.
But I got only one more step until I get to Fleximates.
Okay.
So then Ambrosia was great. I was there for a few years, and there was a point where it was just time to move on. And I ended up going to work for a company in Germany you may have heard of called Cultured Code. They make a product called Things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
Things is a to-do task map.
I've used that. Yes.
Yeah, so then I went there. At that time, they had the Mac version in like a public beta preview. It wasn't actually released. And they had just come out with the iPhone app, which this is back in like 2007 when the iPhone had just come out. So it was a really exciting time, you know, the small company starting up with an iPhone app and a Mac app in public beta. And I went there and it was sort of the head of product or head of marketing, whatever my title was, doesn't matter. But the job was to basically launch things on the Mac and then you know, continue the stuff. And then we ended up launching it on the iPad. And that was where I realized, wow, I love making software. I love doing launches. I love having apps make people's lives better. Because as a productivity tool, I saw how many people benefited from that app. And then I left Cultured Code to start Fleximates, and been doing it since we started in 2010, basically. So I'm doing it about six plus years now. And so I left Cultured Code. Then with me and my business partner, Kent Sutherland, we started up Fleximates, launched Fantastical in 2000. I can't believe my memory is escaping me here, but I believe it's 2011 we launched. Hold on, I'm going to check the timeline right now.
That sounds about right. Yeah, did you hit the ground running in Xcode, or did you have to kind of get up the learning curve on that?
2011. So my role has always been the business marketing design guy. I mean, at the end of the day, I like to consider myself the designer in terms of the app, what it will do, how it will look, how it will feel, how it will function, what it will fix, you know, the problems it'll fix. That's all on me. Now, my business partner, I'm very lucky. He's the best coder I know. So it helps to have a business partner that's the best coder, you know, or be the best coder, you know. But he's also very good in that. There are some coders that are only good in code. He gets design. He gets business. He gets things. I can discuss everything that I'm thinking with him, and he's a great sounding board, and we're quite different people. So he'll give me a really different way to think about things. So it's really nice of how we collaborate together, because you have the yin and the yang kind of coming together and making the best decisions possible.
Cool. Well, that brings us up to date for the first part of the show. This is where we typically take a break, so I think this is a good place to get a break away. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. And Michael, when we return, I want to talk to you about current day and Flexibix and your products and all that good stuff. So folks, stick with us. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back with Michael Simmons from Flexibits. So tell me a little bit about, in the first segment, we were talking about your passion for solving problems. Let's get into that a little bit more, because that is one of the hallmarks of your philosophy we were talking about the other day, was problem solving.
Right. So Fantastical came to be when Kent and I started up Flexibits. One of the key things we had was, what are we going to make, right? It wasn't just like, oh yeah, let's make a calendar app. Kent had a natural processing language engine, or natural parsing engine, whatever you want to call it, NLP, natural language processing, which basically is what Fantastical is, right? So for those of you who are listening who may not know what Fantastical is, it's a calendar app. And it's a full calendar app, so you can see your calendar, manage your calendar, edit, and create events, all that. But
and accesses iCal's database, right?
Exactly. It accesses the calendar database, but an iCloud, but it also accesses everything else from Exchange to Google to Yahoo to your own CalDev, Karyo servers, etc. But the secret sauce and why I think we've been so successful is we have a sentence or natural language processing input area, and you can just type like, podcast with John on Thursday, 9 a.m. Or you can be as natural as you want. And the goal was that the parser would have to be like a person. If there's any specific format you have to use or follow a syntax, it wouldn't be good. So Kent had this engine that would do this, but what would this be? The engine was just, hey, I have this engine that can take natural language English and do something with it. What should we do with it to make it helpful? And that's where I came in, and I was like, well, we should do calendaring. And then originally...
Was this derived from some feeling that iCal wasn't sort of up to par?
So at the time, that was the problem I had. So this is a very big lesson for sure. And I tell this to a lot of people who ask me, you know, what should you do? Solve a problem that you have. Because if you have a problem and you've been looking for a solution and it's not out there, it likely means other people are looking for that solution. So go ahead and solve it really well. Solve it for yourself. You know what I mean?
Right. I did that one time. I wasn't happy with checkbook programs on the early Macs. I wrote my own in BASIC.
I love it. That's how you do it. And the thing is you're scratching an itch for yourself, but there's other Johns out there, right? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I designed Fantastical for myself. I mean, I didn't even design it for Kent. I designed it for myself. Like, I literally said, what would I want in a calendar app? There had been another calendar app I had used that had a menu bar component, you know, so it was a quick app so you could quickly access it from your menu bar. And I love that aspect of it, but there were a lot of things about that app that were very, we'll just say complicated and took extra steps, and it was kludgy, right? It was a nice app, but it was kludgy. So we set out to design Fantastical to be the best app that it could be based upon, I guess, me as the user. And that's what we did. And that's fantastic.
There's a special kind of passion that when you're creating a program for yourself to solve a problem, you get really into doing it right.
Yeah. And not only that, you are able to do things that you want. So if there's a feature that you want, the nice thing about being a designer or a programmer is you can do it. It's like a sandbox. The sky's the limit.
When you design a program like that, do you consciously implement in the code a structure that allows you to do add-ons and to pay attention to security? Or do you get so embroiled in the code itself that that kind of global view doesn't play a big role?
No, and I think a good app and a good programmer will code and design and implement what is necessary. So there's a lot of programmers out there that I'll see will experiment with something or say, oh, I have to add this because someday I might have this. Or there's nothing wrong with being pragmatic, but the more focused you are on what you have now and the more focused you are on making some sort of a roadmap for the short term, not necessarily even the long term, because you can get there. So let me give you a quick example. Let's say you decide, oh, I want to add a ton of different calendar services. Maybe, you know, and in the next year or two, it'd be great if we could add that. But the app's never successful because you took too long to implement this backend that has all of this calendar service. Well, now you failed, right? So you can make something simple, which is what we did with Fantastical One. We leveraged EventKit, which was the built-in code API for calendaring. And by leveraging that, we saved ourselves a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of stress by making our own account system. That paid off because we were able to make a great app quickly, leverage Apple's existing stuff. And even though there were a ton of frustrating points, we got it out. It was a success. And then when we decided to make Fantastical 2, that's when we said, oh, wait, we have this successful app. People want it. Now we can invest some time and money into building an account system. And now we have our own account
system. That's how you solved a problem I was wondering about. Sometimes when you're too expedient and you're too rushed, then later when you want to add features, you find that you backed yourself into a corner by the design of the first version.
Time, or worse, you spend more time implementing something that you may never use, and that delays the product to where the product's a failure or people go to use something different.
Bad business decision because you don't get the product out there to finance your future efforts.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed a lot with certain developers is that they'll have a product that they have such big ambitions for, and meanwhile, 2 years go by, 3 years go by, 5 years go by, and they keep promising updates, and meanwhile, the update never comes out. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a great app, but you know that expression, real artists ship. If you spoke to a lot of people who know me well, I absolutely adhere to real artists ship. I mean, in terms of the amount of apps that I've shipped, not only Flexibits, but I also advise some companies, I've probably shipped, 10 different apps in the last 2 years. So that's a lot of apps. Now, I realize I have multiple teams, but the thing is there's some companies, they haven't even shipped one app in 3 years. So you have to be nimble, you have to be focused, but more importantly, you need to ship because your users want stuff. And it's okay to ship something that's not complete. It's okay to ship something that's missing things because guess what? Your users will wait, they'll want it, they'll crave it. It's okay to build in a demand, I think.
How does that philosophy fit in with the regulations of the App Store? I assume you're in the App Store.
Yes, we're in the App Store, and we also have our own direct. If you want to purchase from us directly, we have that as well.
So some developers have told me that there's some issues with how you manage updates in apps as opposed to coming out with a whole new version.
Well, that has to do with if you're going to charge for a new app. That's a completely different topic, but there's nothing wrong in terms of updates in general. There's no upgrade pricing on the Mac App Store. So let's say you do, Fantastical 3, and no, for your listeners who think there's a Fantastical 3, there's not anyway at this time. Someday there probably will be. But yeah, let's say someone wants to upgrade, let's say we come out with, John version 3. You have to charge a full price. There's no such thing as an upgrade on the Mac App Store, but there's lots of creative ways around it. You can release your app as a sale price, and yes, everyone will get that sale price, but it's better than nothing. There's lots of ways around it. You can basically have a different type of in-app purchase system where the new app could be free, and then people who own the prior one get it unlocked, and then new users have to pay. There's a lot of different ways around it. I don't think it's that big of a problem. I would love to see upgrades on the Mac App Store, but I don't think Apple is going to do upgrades. I just don't think they see upgrades as a thing. I think they see just sell a product and be done with it.
Has the App Store been an important supplement to your basic business, or has it sort of taken over?
In our specific case, and I know from talking to lots of friends, it depends, but in our case, it's definitely been a very nice supplement. If we went all away from the App Store, I definitely think we'd see a decrease in sales, but I don't think you have to be on the App Store. These developers who have left the App Store, obviously still in business and they're doing well. I don't know what type of revenue they've lost, but the App Store to us is very good. It adds a nice option for users. Users who are not technically savvy or want to download and install and license and go through all the stuff of a direct download can just go right on. Yeah, one click done. And, you know, they have the ability to not have to enter their payment information as well. So I think the App Store actually provides a really great service. And one more thing they provide, a lot of people complain about the approval process because as developers, we have to submit the app, wait for it to get approved, mm-hmm. and then it goes on. Which, by the way, Apple has done a great job lately. Approval times are down to like 1 or 2 days now.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I'm happy to hear that you're happy.
Yeah, we're super happy. I mean, you can submit an app now and have it approved the same day, and we've seen this. So very, very, very great improvements going on. I don't know if you heard, but Phil Schiller took over responsibilities of the App Store, and I have to think this is due to him. So feels very nice. But that being said, the App Store is a great experience for users. It's something we definitely are glad and happy to be a part of. Are there frustrations? Sure. And we share them with Apple and hope that someday they will improve them. And we think they will improve most of them. But it's definitely a nice compliment.
Are there any functional differences between Fantastical and the App Store and direct purchase, perhaps due to security limitations or sandboxing or changes in the regulations for the App Store?
Not at this time. And I say not at this time. We don't have anything planned, but you never know. You know, there could be a feature or a change that Apple makes or who knows what. But right now, no, the versions are exactly the same. We get this question a lot. Should I buy from you or the App Store? What's the difference? And I always say there is no difference. We just make more money when you buy from us, but the choice is up to you.
Tell me a little bit about the features of Fantastical that set it apart and solve specific problems that you just can't get to on iCal.
Sure. So just to be clear, we have Fantastical for the Mac. We have Fantastical 2 for the Mac, for the iPhone, and for the iPad. And all three are separate apps. And there's been a lot of debate, and I get a lot of people asking me about this and getting almost frustrated and whatever. But we think it's best to develop each app separately. We think the Mac app and the iPhone app and the iPad app being sold separately, developed separately, and priced separately make the apps better because you focus on them as individual products rather than one thing.
So Apple does the syncing amongst the calendars through iCloud, and then each app on each platform then accesses the current calendar that's been synced.
Right, exactly. Right? So the iPhone version and the iPad version use the same account system setup as the Apple calendar that's built in. So you go to iOS settings, mail contacts, calendars, and that's where your calendars are normally configured for the Apple calendar. Well, when you download Fantastical 2 for iPhone or iPad, you just work. You don't have to configure anything. It just works. So that uses the same sync system that the Apple calendar uses. On Fantastical 2 for Mac, you do have to add your accounts to Fantastical 2 for Mac. We have a very nice setup tool when you first run it. If you have existing calendar accounts, it'll import them and give you the opportunity to quickly set them up. If you don't, you know, it's just a quick click and a username and password away to enter the accounts. But that sync system syncs with whatever you have, iCloud, Google, Exchange, whatever.
Are all these calendars merged into one master calendar, or do you switch between calendars?
No, because it's the calendar that's based off the cloud, so there's nothing to merge. So the calendar that's sitting on your iPhone and your iPad and your Mac is the calendar that's in the cloud.
But what if you're accessing iCloud calendar, but you're also accessing a Google calendar, say?
It's still all accessed from the cloud. It's the network. So it's getting the information from the cloud, mm-hmm. and it's all just displaying it based upon what's on the network.
Cool. What do you think is the major feature of Fantastical that with the biggest problem that it solves over and above, you know, other calendar apps?
It's speed, convenience, and flexibility. So as I mentioned to you earlier, the parsing engine, when you can enter, you know, lunch with John on Friday, 3 p.m., whatever. Oh, you could say meeting every other Wednesday at 4 p.m. Oh, it's very expressive. Our parsing engine actually handles repeating events, tasks, holidays, invites with people. I can go on and on because it has so much, but it's a very, very flexible, friendly, helpful input tool to create your events.
Do you have to take explicit action to make it start listening so that it's only listening when you're talking?
Well, it's not a talking, it's a typing. So you type everything in.
Okay.
Now you can use dictation, which is, you know, built into OS 10 and iOS. You can dictate to it, right? Because dictating is just typing, right?
Right.
But at the end of the day, it is a input by typing method. But again, you can use dictation for that. But the parsing engine, I definitely say, is the thing that makes people, wow, this is different. This is better. This is the app I want to use. The second part is the user interface itself. The way it looks, the way it feels, the way it works, the features it affords. The app itself is really, I mean, to me, I know I'm biased, but the app is a very, very, very powerful, but friendly and easy to use calendar app. And I think people really see the value in that. There are people who complain about the price, but I think those people should just be using Apple Calendar. So if you just need a basic calendar and you don't want any bells or whistles and you don't think a calendar app is worth a lot of money or a decent premium price, then we absolutely think Apple Calendar is a great app. There's nothing wrong with Apple Calendar, but to us, it's frustrating. It takes a lot of time to add events. It's not very intuitive. It doesn't have every feature, and it's not very pretty to look at, we think. So yeah, that's for Fantastical. We think the benefits are the speed, the flexibility, the convenience, and the overall benefits that it adds to making you more productive.
What are the prices on the different platforms?
So the Mac app is $49.99. The iPhone app is $4.99. And the iPad app is $9.99.
Excellent, excellent. And you can get these all at flexibits.com.
Yeah, flexibits.com, FlexiBits.com. And yeah, that's our website.
Now, there is another app that you sell called, if I pronounce it right, Chatology?
Yeah, Chatology.
Okay. Tell us about that.
Chatology is a Mac app that allows you to basically search and find your chats that you do with Messages, you know, the Apple Messages app that comes with OS X. And it allows you to find your chats very quickly, but it also allows you to filter and focus on what you need to find. So let's say you and I chat a lot on Messages. And you sent me an image a few days ago. Well, if you try to do a find with Apple Messages itself, it's very hard to find things. It's slow, and it doesn't really let you filter and drill down. With Chatology, you can set a time frame like all today, last 7 days, last 30 days, etc. You can just look for images. You can just look for links. You can find specific things, and it really allows you to find your messages and content very quickly and easily. Now, it's just for Messages. It's not a chat tool or anything. It's just a find log viewer, if you will, for Messages. And again, it's for Mac only.
Cool, cool. This sounds like a great suite of products. And from what I can tell, they're doing very well. Congratulations.
Thanks.
To you, and congratulations for your Apple Design Award 2015.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Well, you know, we're about out of time. I think we've covered everything. Let's finish up by telling the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
So me personally, I'm at MacGuitar on Twitter. That's MacGuitar. And you can obviously also contact me through flexibits.com.
Excellent. Excellent. So thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it. This has been fun hearing about your history and your evolution and how you came to be where you are, and some really cool products that you've developed. And listeners, thanks for coming by and listening to us. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.